Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, February 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. In just over 2 weeks, NASA's Perseverance rover is set to touch down on the surface of Mars, opening up a new line of exploration on the red planet. In October, a billionaire will lead an all-civilian flight into space aboard a SpaceX orbital rocket. And then there's the, you know, galactic cannibalism. Well, we'll talk about all of that with astronomer Dr. Valerie Rapson, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She is here to answer your questions about space, the final frontier. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Galactic cannibalism. Good. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk astronomy with Dr. Valerie Rapson, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. Dr. Rapson earned her PhD in astrophysical sciences and technology from RIT. Her research focused on the structure and composition of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. Dr. Rapson spent 5 years developing and teaching astronomy education programs for the Dudley Observatory and is now an assistant professor in the Physics and Astronomy Department at SUNY Oneonta. If you have a question about astronomy, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Ray. It's great. How was your holiday? I think it's been since then that I've talked to you.
We got through it just fine. Very little angst. Everyone was healthy. How about you?
Yeah, mine was good as well. About the same.
Now, is SUNY Oneonta ramping up or are they open yet?
They've just opened, and we actually started a few classes in person this week, which have gone pretty well so far. I'm teaching one of my astronomy classes with about 40 students in the classroom, so it's really great to actually see faces again and not just little squares on the computer screen.
And it must make your job teaching astronomy a little easier to be in the same room with people.
Oh, it sure does. I know you can't see me over the phone here, but normally I'm so animated, and I talk with my hands, and I do the demonstrations, and you can't do that online or over the phone as easily. So it's great to be in front of the students.
Indeed. You know, there is some exciting stuff going on, and you sent me a link earlier about the Perseverance rover, which is I think the 8th or 9th landing of some sort of a device designed to explore Mars that we have done. And this one is only I think 15 or 16 days away from landing, and this one looks really cool. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I can't wait. So Perseverance is this like SUV-sized rover. It's similar to the Curiosity rover that landed back in 2012, but it's a little bit bigger and it's much more upgraded. It's going to land on Mars February 18th at 3:30 in the afternoon. People can watch it on NASA TV. They can see it happen live. And this rover is really awesome. It's got all sorts of science instruments. It's got arms that can essentially dig in the ground. It can study the soil. It can analyze the rocks. And it even has the first ever drone that's going to fly around on Mars a few months after the landing. So we're basically going to search for any kind of evidence of alien life with this thing on Mars.
You know, we hope that it will be able to deploy this helicopter. But I looked at the video, and on the website, the NASA website, they have a simulation of the landing. And first, this module comes down, and at supersonic speed, pops a parachute and slows down, and then drops another device that fires retro rockets, and then the Perseverance eventually comes down. I mean, there are a lot of moving parts on this landing.
Yeah, it sure is. And this is actually pretty much identical to how they landed Curiosity. So they've basically done a test run already, and they know that this process works. So fingers crossed that it'll work this time. But one upgrade that Perseverance has is it actually has video cameras on the bottom, so it can autonomously decide if it's hovering over the wrong place to land, like if there's large boulders or a cliff or something that we didn't know about. And it will actually move a little bit and shift and find itself a safe and comfy place to land if it perceives danger there. So this is actually, in theory, a little bit better of a landing than we had for Curiosity, as scary as it sounds.
Now, how far is Mars, like 36 million miles away? How far away is it from Earth?
Yeah, ballpark. It's about 50 million miles away at the closest approach. So when Earth and Mars are, you know, on the same side of the sun, it's about 50 million miles away, give or take a little bit.
How long?
So I'd have to check and see exactly where it is, like right now. But
right. But I mean, in general, how long does it take telemetry to leave Mars and reach our listening stations?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You're getting at this whole 7 minutes of terror idea. Yeah, so there's going to be another one of those. So it takes at least 7 minutes for the data to go from Mars to the Earth. So, you know, when it says that, you know, we're just starting to land, what's actually happening is it's already 7 minutes ahead of where it tells us it is, because our time is delayed. So we're going to, you know, chew on our fingernails for about 7 minutes before we can actually hear if it landed successfully or not.
We're joined today by Dr. Valerie Rapson. We talk astronomy on Vox Pop, and feel free to give us a shout if you wish. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. A number of science experiments are on the Perseverance, and I understand it's pretty much geared toward looking for evidence of fossilized life, or maybe even life that's there now, where we'll be checking oxygen content in the atmosphere. What other things
right.
will the Perseverance be looking at?
Yeah, it's got all sorts of abilities to do biological experiments, search for water, basically heat up soil samples and test and see if anything moves, right? Our idea is if there are living creatures in the soil now and you heat them up, they might change. They might die or they might change due to that heat. So it will test for all of that. But it's also bringing this experiment called MOXIE, which is going to attempt to take the carbon dioxide out of the Martian atmosphere and convert it to just the O2, so basically remove the carbon. And this would be useful for us to make oxygen if we ever travel there with human beings, but also to potentially make rocket fuel out of that oxygen as well. So this will be a great test for that type of a science experiment.
And you mentioned the drone, and you know, they've been talking about flying a helicopter on Mars, and they may have already done it on Titan. If I'm not sure if I dreamed that up or whether they were talking about doing that as well. But
yeah.
You know, the Martian atmosphere is very thin. I'm not exactly sure
right.
of my aerodynamic principles here, but you have a helicopter. Doesn't it need some air to fly around, or am I wrong?
Yeah, so the one on Titan was really just a lander. It kind of floated down, and the atmosphere on Titan is a lot thicker than it is on Mars. But yeah, that's one of the things that they're testing. So there is some air on Mars, but it's not the same kind of air as Earth, and the pressure is actually only about 1% the pressure that we have on Earth. So as you said, it's far less dense, and we're not entirely sure if the drone is going to fly properly. But I mean, the engineers had an idea of what the surface would be like, and they've designed it appropriately. But that's kind of the big experiment is will the drone fly, and will it work like we anticipate it'll work? Because yeah, the atmosphere on Mars is very different than what we have on Earth.
All right, one item before we take a break and then hit the phones and the emails. And I got to tell
sure.
you, this scared the daylights out of me. I sent you the link. Astronomers find origins of galactic cannibalism with discovery of ancient dark matter halo. A, what does it mean?
Right.
And B, why should I be scared?
Yeah, I love galactic cannibalism because it's just such a hilarious term. And I envision like a galaxies with mouths chomping on other
yeah.
galaxies. But this is actually, so it's just a little baby galaxy. We call these dwarf galaxies. And there's a whole bunch of them that orbit around the Milky Way. We've discovered, I don't know, 40 or 45 of them. They're much smaller than our galaxy. But what was found here is this little galaxy seems to have a lot more dark matter than we predicted. Dark matter is that mysterious material that we can't actually see around the edge of the galaxies, but it interacts gravitationally with the stars. And it seems to be a lot further away from the center of this small galaxy. And this small galaxy may eventually get cannibalized by the Milky Way and then, you know, give the Milky Way a little bit more dark matter.
All right, fair enough. Well, let's take a quick break here. 800-348-2551 is the number if you want to talk to Dr. Valerie Rapson as we discuss astronomy today. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get to the calls. We'll get to the email coming up. Thank you. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us today from SUNY Oneonta, and we talk astronomy today on the program. A couple of emails here, Val, and then we'll get to the phones. This one's from Ben in Guilderland. Ben says, two moon questions. Last week, I saw the most beautiful full moon low on the horizon. Looked huge and bright and orange. Weirdly, later in the evening, it was higher up in the sky, and it was silver white again. Can you explain this? I thought it was only orange during an eclipse, and that's question one.
Sure, yeah. So that has to do with Earth's atmosphere. When the moon is really low in the sky, the sunlight is actually passing through a thicker atmosphere, and our atmosphere does a great job of scattering blue light. That's why our sky looks blue during the day. All the blue light from the sun is scattered, and the red light makes it through. So when we are looking through our atmosphere at the moon when it's low in the sky, we are only seeing the red light that's bounced off the moon that makes it through to our eyes. We're not seeing as much of the blue and the greens and the other colors of light. But by the time the moon rises high in the sky, we're looking through less atmosphere, and we're seeing more of all colors of the rainbow come through. So the moon looks white again. So it just has to do with how much atmosphere we have to look through, depending on the height of the moon in the sky.
All right, Ben's second question. Ben writes, I heard that the moon used to be bigger in the night sky in ancient history. Is this true? How long ago was that? And how much bigger was it? And that's from Ben in Guilderland.
Yeah, so the size, the apparent size of the moon hasn't changed in a long time. The moon does ever so slightly move away from the Earth, but you know, throughout all of our lifetimes, we're going to basically see same size, same distance moon. So no, it hasn't really changed very much, at least not in the historical astronomy records that we've kept track of. But sometimes it appears to look bigger, again, when it's lower in the sky, which is just a perspective issue.
All right.
And not actually bigger.
This one's from Mike in Rexford. Mike says, I remember that in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a radio telescope located in the hills above the west side of Lake George near Bolton Landing. It's gone now. Do you know the story of this? Who built it? Why it was built? Why it's gone? That's from Mike in Rexford.
Yeah, you know, honestly, Mike, I don't know. I hadn't heard of that, but I'm going to have to look it up now. I mean, unfortunately, I wasn't around then to see it, but it sounds really awesome. If we had a radio telescope here in New York and, you know, maybe we did some cool astronomy with it, I'll have to see if there were any big discoveries made.
All right. Then one more email from Joe in Hageman. Joe says, in 2009, astronomers exploring a giant cloud of gas and dust at the center of the Milky Way made a surprise discovery. There was a region notable for being full of ethyl alcohol or ethanol, the type we use to make alcoholic beverages. They said it contains enough alcohol to supply every person on the Earth with 300,000 pints of beer per day for the next billion years. Why haven't we tapped into that like solar energy? Thirsty and Hageman, that's Joe. Is that true?
Yeah, well, no, it's definitely true. There's all sorts of alcohols out there. And the running joke is that the universe is filled with alcohol, but we haven't yet found any caffeine to deal with the hangover.
Ah, there you are.
So we're still searching for that caffeine molecule. But yeah, no, he's totally right. There's all sorts of, you know, theoretically drinkable and non-drinkable alcohol all over the place in our galaxy.
I never knew that. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. We talk astronomy today. Let's go to the phones at 800-348-2551. Sarah is in Schenectady. Sarah, you're on.
Hi there. I'm very curious about something I heard on the station earlier today when they were talking about landing on Europa, the moon of Jupiter. And I was wondering, won't communication from Europa be continually interrupted through electromagnetic pulsating because of the radiation on Europa? And I'm getting an echo, so I'm going to take my answer off the phone.
All right, Sarah, thanks for the call. Val.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm going to have to, you know, tune back in and see what was going on earlier. But yeah, there are many missions planned to Jupiter's moons, including the Europa Clipper, and there's another one, I think it's called JUICE, the Jupiter Icy something. I forget what the letters stand for. But yeah, there's some moon missions planned to check out Europa and see if they can peer through the icy crust and ultimately search for evidence of aquatic life on this moon. Now, your comment about the signals being disrupted a little bit, Yeah, I think that's something that we do have to think about because Jupiter, being a gas giant, being the biggest moon, does have a really strong magnetic field. And it's not the magnetic field of the moon, it's the magnetic field of Jupiter and the radiation that gets trapped within that and then, you know, ultimately hits the moon that we have to be concerned about. So yeah, I'm sure the engineers have to, you know, make sure that they consider that. I don't think it would be blocked completely because we have, you know, satellites that are orbiting Jupiter now and sending back information. But we'll definitely need to, you know, make sure the radiation levels aren't too high for this Clipper mission that's headed there soon.
Now, quickly, before we go to the next call, just tell me a little more about Europa. Now, how thick is this ice and is it, in fact, water?
Yeah, so we do, in fact, know that it is water, at least underneath the crust. And the actual thickness of the ice layer is a little bit unclear. It's probably a few miles thick. We definitely have never, like, seen the water layer directly underneath, but there are cracks all over the surface, and water ice particles shoot out of the cracks. So we have detected them, and spectroscopically we can tell that it is water ice and that there must be an ocean underneath. But exactly how thick it is and exactly how much water is there is still something we're working on figuring out. But definitely enough water for a full ocean, potentially aquatic life, and even oxygen content high enough to support life that actually breathes oxygen on this moon. So it'd be super cool to actually go there and start scuba diving in this ocean.
Let's put your physics hat on for a moment. And you'd mentioned the radiation from Jupiter,
yeah.
And it's formidable. How much, how do I put this? What is the insulating ability of water or ice from radiation? In other words, if there was something living way down there, is the ice and the water enough of a shield against this radiation?
Yeah, we actually think so. So what's cool about the ice is that, one, it does act as a pretty good radiation shield, especially if it's a couple miles thick. The life underneath would be fine a couple miles down. But the radiation also funnels charged particles that come from the sun that get trapped. And when these charged particles hit the ice, they can break apart the H2O molecule and any organics that might be sitting on the surface and actually feed the water layer then with hydrogen and oxygen or organic material that could eventually form life. So Jupiter's magnetic field and the radiation could have in part helped some sort of life form on these moons. So while it's bad in some sense, it could have been a good thing in another sense. So if we do find life there, we're going to have to really study it and see exactly how it came to be on that moon.
So interesting. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. We talk astronomy on Vox Pop. And let's go back to the phones. Mike is in Woodstock. Mike.
Hi. I'm following up on a previous caller's question about how the mission to Mars will be communicating back to Earth. If she could just explain a little bit about the details of the technology, because there's so many communications, I'm guessing video, audio, and a number of other things. I'm just interested in knowing how the communications are going to travel 50 million miles and the technology, if it's different than the moon missions of 40 years ago, for example. I'm going to get off the phone and listen.
Okay, Mike, thanks a lot.
Sure. Yeah, so you're right. There's all sorts of cameras and information that's going to be sent back to Earth. So all of it is going to be done via radio signals. And usually with spacecrafts like this, we use something called the Deep Space Network, which is a collection of radio telescopes at different locations on Earth. They're all big radio dishes that are designed to pick up these signals from spacecraft that are orbiting from other planets. Now, Perseverance, I would guess, since it's going to land on the surface, will send its signals up to one of the satellites. Usually they use the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I'm not positive that they're going to use it this time around, but usually the signals go from the rover to a satellite on Mars, and then the radio signals are sent to the Deep Space Network, which we get here on Earth. Now, to get like high-resolution images and video back, that definitely takes some time. So on landing day, we're unfortunately not going to have a live feed of what's actually going on. We're going to get telemetry and super basic information from the rover that says, yes, I landed, hopefully, and everything is good to go. But they're expecting a couple days to go by before we get some video. But there will, after a couple of days, be high-resolution video and sound, which I'm really excited about, of the whole landing process. So we'll get to see and hear what it was like to be on Mars during the landing after the data comes back.
That is amazing. And I remember seeing this article a couple of days ago now. Yeah, the fact that there will be a microphone there is really intriguing to me. I imagine we won't hear much but wind, right?
Yeah, so that's what we don't really know. What are the sounds going to be like? They actually tried to send a microphone, I think, on two different missions, and both of them failed, so we don't actually have any sound from Mars yet. But as we said before, the atmosphere of Mars is different, so the way sound travels through Mars is different. And because the atmosphere is low density, it'll probably be a lot quieter than standard wind on Earth. And also maybe a little bit higher pitch. We'll have to see, because the speed of sound will be a little bit different. But yeah, I don't know. I'm sure we'll get a lot of the whooshing sound from the retro rockets and the air that gets kicked up. But we'll have to see what, if any, other sounds we can pick up that are just ambient on Mars that we've never heard before.
Well, we're building it up pretty big. I hope they land this thing properly. Valerie Rapson is our guest today, and it's astronomy on the show. Mike is in Saratoga Springs. Mike, you're on.
Hey, how are you today? I'm attempting to answer a question as well from earlier about the telescope on the west side of Lake George up in Bolt Landing.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, tell me about it.
This is exactly, it involves also Wernher von Braun, who was, I know, obviously a famous NASA person and would probably be very proud of the mission to Mars right now. But it actually involves a family friend, and I don't know if Ray's old enough to remember Timetown, which was an amusement park up there.
Timetown?
And, no. Yeah, it didn't last long.
I remember Storytown, I remember Frontier Town, but I don't think I remember Timetown.
Well, this is a gentleman who had a built-in workforce of 14 children. His name was Ted Gund, and he bought a really powerful Celestron telescope. I believe it was like one of the most powerful in the northeastern United States. He needed a very dark place to work, and he bought some property up on Lake George and put it up there. And it was such a cool thing. He decided to build a little amusement park around it called Timetown about futuristic stuff, and had all his kids and friends work there. But I'm not sure if that's exactly, but it was in its time well known. And he actually somehow boondoggled to get Wernher von Braun to come up there and dedicate the telescope, which is pretty funny.
That's cool.
I don't know if Wernher von Braun knew exactly what he was getting into, but in any case, it didn't last too long. And, you know, Ted Gund is no longer with us, but many of his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are still in the upstate New York area. I'm just a family friend, but that may be the telescope they're referring to. And there's still remnants. If you know where it is, you can still see some of the leftover remnants of that amusement park.
Well, summertime adventure for sure. I'm definitely going to check this out.
Yeah, and I got to look up Timetown now. I mean, there was Gaslight Village, there was Frontier Town, there was Story. Timetown is a new one. Valerie Rapson is our guest from SUNY Oneonta. We talk astronomy today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Stephen in Monticello. Stephen.
Yes, sir.
You're on.
Good afternoon. I read this morning about meteors hitting Mercury. Is that true?
Ooh. I hadn't seen the article, but yeah, it probably is true. Occasionally, we've got rocks that smack into other planets. Was there a collision recently?
They did say it was a collision. What I was wondering is there going to be any pictures of that?
Ooh,
well,
I'll
you don't know. You haven't heard really about that. So.
Well, no, but here's the thing. If they knew that the meteor hit, then they must have seen something, because there's so many craters on Mercury that it's unlikely that they would have, you know, noticed a random new one. So if they knew that a meteor hit, there might be photographs, or we might be able to go photograph the landing spot and see if there's a new crater there.
Yeah, maybe that'll be on the Discovery Channel someday or something.
Yeah.
All right. Have a nice day. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Valerie Rapson is our guest. Let's talk about Mercury for a minute here. Now, it's never visible from the naked eye, or is it?
No, it is visible. It's just so close to the sun that it's often difficult to see because you got to catch it really low on the horizon just after sunset or just before sunrise. And oftentimes, if you've got any city glow, it just gets washed in the sunset glow and it's very hard to see. But with a small telescope, as long as you're careful not to point the telescope at the sun, you can definitely pick up Mercury.
And it's a small planet, right? I mean, give me a perspective as to the other seven planets, how big it is.
Yeah, it's about a third the diameter of Earth. So it's pretty small, and it's a solid rock, mostly metal. I believe it's got a little bit higher density than the Earth does. So it's a lot. It's the smallest of our planetary objects.
And it's tidally locked with the sun, or am I wrong?
Almost. I think it's like 1.5 rotations every time it goes around. So it almost always shows the same face to the sun, but not quite. And that makes one side of the planet super hot. We're talking like 800 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the side that's not facing the sun stays really cold, like minus 300 degrees Fahrenheit, because of that slow rotation rate.
And there's no atmosphere to speak of?
Not really. They've detected like, you know, little bits of maybe helium and stuff like that, but not anything substantial.
Well, you know, you mentioned 800 degrees, which I think is in line somewhat with what Venus is. And I know the Russians landed some landers that they didn't last more than 20 minutes or whatever onto Venus.
Yeah.
But given the fact that there's not much atmosphere on Mercury, I mean, can we land on Mercury and learn some stuff?
Oh, yeah. In theory, we definitely could. The tricky part is not so much landing on Mercury and surviving. It's getting to Mercury without accidentally being caught up in the sun's gravitational pull. So there's a mission on the way now called BepiColombo. I don't believe it's going to land. I think it's just going to orbit around Mercury. But to do this, we have to send these spacecrafts towards the sun and then make them orbit multiple times around the sun and occasionally come back out around the Earth or other planets and slowly spiral in so that once we get close enough to Mercury, the gravity of Mercury will capture the spacecraft and the spacecraft won't actually get caught up by the sun and melt. So the tricky part is slowing down enough to get into Mercury's orbit without being gobbled up by the sun.
That's so interesting. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. It's Astronomy Today on the program. 800-348-2551 is the number. This email came in from not sure who, doesn't say. Just how close can two planets get to each other if everything were balanced out in the given solar system? In other words, can they pass within 100 miles of each other? How about even closer? Not mountaintop shaving, but close. And that is from apparently Anonymous.
Yeah, so I guess the good news is that all of our planets are in nice, happy, stable orbits around the sun, so nothing is going to get too close. Technically, the closest planet to the Earth is Venus, right? It's only about 30, 40 million miles away. It's a little bit closer than Mars is at its closest approach. So to the Earth, that is the closest planet to us. And then, you know, Mercury is another 30-ish million miles away from Venus. So that's about as close as planets get, within a few, 30 million miles or so. Thankfully, the planets, they don't deviate from their orbits and they don't get any closer, because as soon as planets get close to one another, then the gravitational pulls start to really affect things. So we don't want another planet to get any closer to Earth than the ones that are already there.
This one from Chuck in Westfield, Massachusetts. Chuck writes, how do astronomers explain the size of the universe? I would think there would have to be an end to the universe, but there can't be an end. And that's from Chuck in Westfield.
Yeah, that's one of, you know, the ultimate questions that we're trying to figure out is what exactly is the shape and just how big is the universe? The only thing we can really do at this point is directly study our observable universe, which is basically the extent to which we can see based on the limitations of the speed of light. So we can measure with different techniques the distances to other galaxies and get a sense of the size and potentially the shape of our universe. And, you know, we can see about, 14 billion miles away. That's where the age of the universe comes from. But in reality, the universe could be a lot larger. You know, we know that the expansion of the universe has increased. So physically, it's more like 96 billion light years big. And, we're still trying to figure out exactly if it has an edge or, you know, what's going on. But we're kind of limited by what we're able to see. and then we just have to trust the math to tell us the rest.
You know, you mentioned 14 billion light years, or whatever the distance is.
Yeah.
Why is our vision limited there?
Because it has to do with the speed of light. Since the speed of light is limited, it takes time for that light to travel. And we know that the light was emitted at a certain point, you know, 380,000 years after the beginning of the universe. And in that time, light has only been able to travel so far. So we have a limit as to how far away we can see. And there's also this thing called expansion and inflation that grew the universe potentially faster than the speed of light before the visible light was emitted. So the actual universe can be bigger than what we can see. But it's all limited by the concept that information and light can't go faster than the speed of light.
Our guest today is Dr. Valerie Rapson. We talk astronomy, and if you have a question, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a break and be back. Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. SUNY Oneonta's Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us, and Lawrence is in Hyde Park. Lawrence, you're on.
Oh, good afternoon. I just have a quick question. I caught your show when you were talking about a Mars landing or a Mars mission.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, is that happening now or in the near future? That's my question.
Well, a couple of weeks, right, Val?
Yeah. February 18th, 3:30 p.m. in the afternoon Eastern time, which is great because usually they're at like 2 a.m. But this time it's at a comfortable time. Everyone can watch 3:30 in the afternoon.
And you would go to NASA.gov, right?
Yep. NASA TV, NASA.gov. You can find all the information on how to watch it live. And they're going to have people in the control room and, you know, explaining what's going on. So it'll be a fun event to watch live.
Well, great. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
You betcha. Thanks, Lawrence. Awesome. You know, they have a great channel on, you know, if you got a Roku or whatever, you get the NASA channel.
Mm-hmm.
Watching some of these landings or launches on the NASA channel is amazing. They have so many expert people on. Yeah, you watch, right?
I do. It's just great because these people dedicate their lives to these missions. And you forget that, you know, Perseverance took, I don't know, the last 20 years to build and put together and plan. So people have their whole careers embedded in these spacecrafts. And then when they finally successfully land, there's like tears of joy everywhere. It's amazing to watch.
It's pretty exciting. One of the launches I saw during the pandemic, it was a little sad because they all wanted to hug each other. They had to stay 6 feet from each other. But that'll change too. We have a billionaire. His name, it eludes me, Jared Isaacman, right?
Yeah, Jared Isaacman, yep.
And he's going to take four civilians, including himself, four civilians into space on a SpaceX in the fall.
Yeah, and one of them could be you, Ray. All you got to do is donate to St. Jude, and your ticket is in for a potential ride on that ship.
I'm not sure I'll make the wait, but we'll see what we can do.
Did
you see that SpaceX, the Starship test yesterday, another problem with the landing?
I did. Yeah, I watched it. We had seen the last two live, and it's really cool. If people haven't seen it, they're basically trying to land these giant rockets, and they're doing it by launching about 10 kilometers up and then essentially letting them belly flop down to just, you know, naturally fall as they would from space. And then they turn the engines back on to straighten them back out, and they're trying to do what they do on those drone ships, right, is delicately land the rockets back down. But with this one, they haven't been successful yet. These are, I think, the Starship series.
Yeah.
They're still working on getting them to land straight up and down. So far, they've just pretty much belly flopped to the ground and exploded.
You know, it amazes me. Some of the nonchalant atmosphere. There's so much money going into SpaceX. One of the leaders of the team has said, we got to work on the landing a little bit. I mean, the thing blew up.
Right. And the other thing, if you watch the video, you notice that they have the next one. This was Starship 9. The next one, Starship 10, is ready to be tested. And it's just chilling on the launch pad right next to this other one that they're pretty sure was going to crash land. And they were like, oh, well, if we accidentally hit number 10, we'll just roll out number 11 and try again. And I'm like, what? You must have so much money to just keep building these rockets and blowing them up.
But it's an exciting time, though, isn't it?
It is. It really is. This whole idea of privatizing space flight is really fascinating, because if it was just NASA doing this and our tax dollars funding it, you know, normal people like you and me wouldn't be able to go on these trips. But now with the private companies working towards space travel, anybody has the opportunity to get trained and go. And yeah, it's going to be great.
Would you go?
You know, I don't know. I really want to experience weightlessness in some form. So I might go if it was like an orbital trip. I have no desire to go to the moon or Mars. I'm not that quite that adventurous. But I definitely want to go to a point where I could experience weightlessness.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's Astronomy on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. And Ken is in Albany. Ken, you're on.
Hello, Dr. Rapson. I'm a Ken Gasiuk. I'm a friend of Harry and Judy. I think we've met before. I have a question about the lava tubes on Mars. Do you know of any programs or vessel, any devices, whatever, to do something like ground-penetrating radar or something to investigate the extent, depths, proportions of some of the lava tubes under the surface of Mars? You can guess why there's a lot of interest in that, protected from the radiation and potentially being able to be sealed off for future occupation.
Right. I haven't seen anything specifically about investigating the lava tubes. They've been so interested in the places where there is or used to be water on Mars and searching for current life that I don't know that they've paid too much attention to the lava tubes, but some of the upcoming satellites may have the radar capabilities. I know they're able to peer through the icy layer, so maybe the next generation will be able to peer below the ground and do, as you said, map those lava tubes and maybe look for a new home for our future Mars astronauts. You never know.
Right. I have a couple other questions, if I might be so bold.
Well, we got a lot of calls. How about one, Ken? How about one more?
Very good. The crater... There are many craters that, as the seasons change and the surface of Mars warms up, there are like dark streaks that often come from the slipping rims of dust material falling down with colors that have been thought to, that might be due to water melting out within the soil that is, Martian soil is drifting down. I would love to have a drone or something go sample that to see if there really is liquid water coming out of crater rims.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, I guess that's not a question.
If this drone on Perseverance works well, I think that's exactly what we can do, because these drones are small and theoretically easy to maneuver. So we can send one to the edge of a hill, and if it crashes or tumbles down the hill, like, no big deal. I think that'll be the next thing that we do, too, because there's probably this water, you know, just below the surface that we haven't quite tapped into, and we just need an instrument capable of doing it.
All right.
Tapped into. I like that. So with the drones, are they capable of grabbing samples and going back to the base, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. They definitely will be. I don't know that the Perseverance one has the ability to do that, but standard drones today, they could definitely go get samples, bring it back to the main robot, and do some tests on it.
Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Valerie Rapson is our guest. 800-348-2551, the telephone number. Brendan in Boston. Brendan, you're not really in Boston, are you?
Well, I'm heading back to Boston. I just came from UMass Amherst.
Oh, fair enough.
Where I got vaccinated, and I'm on Route 90, and I'm heading back into town.
All right, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, enjoying the show. I've read an inordinate amount of information about the Big Bang Theory, and I've watched many programs about it, and I still can't quite comprehend it, and definitely could never explain it to anybody. Could you, for dummies, explain the Big Bang Theory?
Yeah, in the 30 seconds that I have, I'll do my best. Yeah, so The idea starts that our universe was, you know, infinitesimally small. We can't really explain what our universe was at the very beginning or you know, anything that was happening. But some sort of quantum fluctuation triggered our universe to expand. And it's that point onward that we think we have a little bit of an understanding of. After the universe started to expand, and, you know, again, exactly what caused that is still to be determined, things began to expand outwards and grow in size, and then the universe continued to cool, and ultimately, you know, you formed atoms, and then you released light, and then you kind of grew into forming stars and galaxies and planets and people. So the Big Bang Theory is really just the concept that at some time ago, roughly 14 billion years ago, something triggered the creation of our universe, which has been ever expanding since. How's that for a simple for dummies explanation?
That's pretty good.
Now I totally get it, and I'll be able to explain it to anybody.
Hey, Brendan.
There you go, right? Tell all your friends.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. Valerie Rapson joins us as we talk astronomy today. Dave is in Woodstock. Hello there, Dave.
Hello. I heard, I think, on Radiolab or another show that ice can form above freezing temperatures in the desert for water collection. This is a planetary question.
Mm.
Is that possible?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me. Something about radiation cooling.
Yeah, it depends on, you know, the exact pressure and salt content of water, you know, those types of things. We
Ray,
see that happen on other planets.
Yes, Dave.
Okay. Before you cut me off,
did
down
you hear
here
the
in Woodstock,
answer?
we're radiational.
Did you hear the answer that Valerie gave?
Not yet, but please. We need NASA Channel down here in Woodstock, and please call in to get NASA Channel on Spectrum.
I see.
You have it in Albany, but we don't have it down here.
Well,
in
actually, I don't know if they have it on Spectrum. I get it on the Roku, but on Pluto TV,
I
think.
Spectrum. Absolutely, they had it.
All right, man. Well, listen, I appreciate the call. Yeah. Thanks very much. And the REO Speedwagon in the background or whatever you had going was really tasteful. Jeff in Statsburg. Jeff, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. I was just wondering about your dwarf galaxies, and say it seems they have like extra gravity, which makes you figure that there's dark matter there. I was just wondering, is the presence of a black hole also measured by gravity?
Yeah. So let me explain a little bit more what they saw with these dwarf galaxies. So most galaxies, we think, have a supermassive black hole at the center. Sometimes dwarf galaxies do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're just too small to actually have them. And with this galaxy that's orbiting the Milky Way, they found some stars that were further away from the center, and they appeared to be gravitationally bound to the galaxy. And they orbit at a faster speed than we would expect for stars that are that far away from the center. Because you're right, the black hole is the main gravitational hub that holds the material together. But this existence of dark matter, mostly at the edge of galaxies, is this additional gravitational source that interacts with the stars and makes them orbit more quickly than we would anticipate if all of the gravity was at the center. So most galaxies, including these dwarf galaxies, they have both. They have gravity from that supermassive black hole. They have gravity at the edges from this mysterious dark matter. And both are affecting the orbits of the stars.
Well, I think I have some studying to do. Thank you very much. And congratulations on finding such a fascinating career. And I wish you a long and happy career.
Thank you. Definitely a blast, for sure.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us today as we talk astronomy. 800-348-2551. Don't call if you want to complain about your cable provider. There's not a lot we can do here in public radio about that. Let's go to Paul in Hyde Park. Paul, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Rapson. Thanks for taking the call today.
Hey.
Hey, I have a quick question for you. Right now, you touched on it briefly earlier. Right now, we're limited by communications delays due to the vast distances and the speed of light. I keep reading about Chinese scientists, and we have scientists here in the U.S. too, that are using quantum entanglement to encode information and transmit it instantaneously over further and further distances. I think the Chinese have recently announced they've transmitted over kilometers. do you envision at some time in the somewhat near future that we might have quantum entangled devices, telemetry devices, et cetera, that would transmit nearly instantaneous data transfer from here to, say, Mars and elsewhere?
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool? That would be awesome. I mean, it's definitely something that they're working towards, right? That's why they're working on these experiments. And to be honest, quantum mechanics is, you know, at that level is a little bit over my head in the quantum tunneling. But my understanding is, you know, they're able to entangle these things and essentially instantly share information, but only small bits, right? I think the challenge is going to be when I have a lot of information, how do I entangle it so that I can get it to travel instantaneously? Right now, I think we're sending, like, a particle, basically, not a whole bunch of information.
Right, right.
But, yeah, I mean, if it keeps going this way, I mean, if the physics says it can happen, let's do it. That'd be awesome if we could just instantaneously get information or maybe transport, right? That's what Star Trek did. We can get some transporters out of this in the distant future.
I like it. Paul, thank you for the call. Would you, Valerie, I asked you if you'd go to space, but would you be willing to try out a teleportation experiment?
Oh, man. That's a totally different question. If I could live in the universe of Star Trek, I think definitely the answer would be yes. I mean, I know what the worst is that can happen, but I think I've just to say that you tried it and you were that test experiment.
Okay.
I think it'd be cool. So, as long as, you know, didn't come out too bad on the other end.
Well, all right. You know, by the way, we only have a couple of minutes here, and I wanted to throw this one by you. You are an educator,
sure.
And you also did your research on planet-forming disks. And I thought this was so cool. This was on space.com a few days ago. This could be the start of two brilliant scientific careers. Two Massachusetts high schoolers, 16-year-old Kartik Pingley and 18-year-old Jasmine Wright, helped discover four new alien planets, a new study reports.
Oh,
isn't that
that's
cool?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Yeah, I love that, you know, astronomy has grown so big and the technology is so accessible that astronomers can work with high school students and really get some cool data analysis done. They discovered some exoplanets, right? Some planets around other stars.
200 light years away, which is close in the neighborhood, but that's so far away.
Right?
And they use this planet, this dips in the light curve. Explain that in about 30 seconds, how you do that.
Yeah. I think I had heard that they use TESS, which is a space telescope that looks at how bright the stars are, and they monitor the brightness of stars over time. And if the star ever dims for a few minutes or an hour or something, then that could be because a planet moved between our observation and the star and blocked out the light. So students can very easily look at these light curves and watch and see if the star dims and then maybe attribute that to a planet that's orbiting around it.
Now, do any of your students at SUNY Oneonta get to use TESS?
Not at the moment. Our astronomers here are not so much in the exoplanet field, but, you know, I'm brand new here, and I can't wait to start utilizing the stuff we have on campus and think about other projects that we could use, you know, TESS and other big space telescopes with the students. So ask me again in a year, and the answer might be different. I'll leave it at that.
So what you're saying is you're going to cause a whole mess of trouble for all the old-timers at SUNY Oneonta. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Good. Definitely. We're going to do some really fun stuff with the students.
Good for you, Dr. Valerie Rapson. Well, this was a fun show. Anything I should be looking for in the night sky, assuming it's not snowing?
Well, Mars is up there now. Mars is great to look for, constellation of Orion. I think we've got a little time before any good meteor showers are coming up. So, you know, just enjoy the night sky, especially if it's above freezing. You know, go outside and look at those beautiful stars.
Yeah, you know, that's great advice, and we try to do it all we can. Dr. Valerie Rapson, thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Talk to you soon. Support comes from Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever, agstewardship.org. And Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 30 years, qfcc.com. Well, once again, thanks to Dr. Valerie Rapson of SUNY Oneonta for being with us today. Terrific calls, everybody. Nice job. Thank you for the emails as well. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Jordan Yuxall, our producers Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Hey, you got some aches and pains from the old shoveling? We got Matthew Goodemo tomorrow. He'll talk physical therapy with you. That's at 2 p.m. tomorrow. Hope to see you then. Right now, stand by for 51%.